playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. What is it about 2018? Yet again, profound sadness as another creative genius leaves us. President Michael D. Higgins led the tributes to Mihola Suluon, the musician, composer, educator, man of ideas, who died on Tuesday evening. He was 67. Tirnanog, played by Mihola Suluon for the TV series River of Sound. Filmmaker Philip King was a longtime collaborator. He remembered his friend on Today with Sean O'Rourke.
He was so multifaceted, really, wasn't he? I think he was a leader. He was pragmatic. He was political. He was cultural. He was a gifted artist. And above all else, he was a magnificent teacher. He took a music, an Irish traditional music, which at that time, I suppose if you go back to the 60s and 70s, was beginning to find its voice. And he took it from the places that he found it. He respected the well of tradition out of which it came, and he brought it in to the university. He had studied with Sean O'Riordan, who was a huge influence on him. He had studied with Tomás O'Connor and worked with him as well. And then when the University of Limerick was founded, I think that Ed Walsh saw in Micheál something really, really powerful. He brought him to UL, and I remember myself and Nuala and Micheál going to a lunch in UL to sit down and to talk to Ed Walsh about the power of music. And it was out of that lunch and that meeting that the series that we made together, A River of Sound, came together. And it was just a fantastic journey for me. I'm bereft. I loved him dearly, and I'm just so sad that he's gone.
We can sense your sense of loss and your grief this morning, but I suspect gratitude as well?
A huge amount of gratitude. Where he led, we would always follow. His passion, his energy, his vigour, his voltage. He has left an indelible thumbprint on the landscape of Irish music. And I will say this, that his generosity, his strategic ability to engage with people, to give him the resources that he needed to go to work. He was able to explain to people that there was no metric for priceless. And what he did for us, what he did for Ireland, what he did for our music was to put it at a different level, not just as an entertainment. It's priceless, his contribution to who and what we are. And as we head towards independence for 100 years in 3 years' time, I would think that his contribution to our identity, our sense of self, is undoubtedly priceless. Ní bheidh a le héad a rís ann.
Philip King. Well, Shannó singer Iarla O'Linnard from the Gloaming also worked closely with Mihola Suluon. He described him as an extraordinary man, a polymath, a visionary, a man passionate about education, who understood the centrality of the arts in education. In fact, Iarla studied for his master's degree under Mihola's supervision, as he told Rachel English.
I remember very well going down to University of Limerick when I heard they had the type of master's programme that I might be interested in doing. And I remember meeting him in the library there, and he pulled out a volume, a slim but very important volume, How Musical Is Man by John Blacking. He had studied under John Blacking in Belfast. I remember him handing it to me. And then subsequently, I would sometimes, probably feeling a little leaden about my own prospects and how I was getting on, I would go into his office, and I always left a foot taller. Whatever state I was in going in, I left fairly transformed. He was very encouraging. You always felt very emboldened after meeting him in the academic setting.
Yeah, I remember interviewing him around the time of A River of Sound. I actually was in the University of Limerick, and that enthusiasm, that spirit, that passion seemed to carry over into everything he did.
Absolutely. You know, I think he belonged to a generation in University College Cork. The energy of that wave of the likes of Sean O'Riordan and Sean O'Toole, and then the poetry of the Inti poets of that era, they saw something in the culture, the older culture, but they didn't see it as something static or old. They saw it as a sort of a catalytic energy that they could tap into, that they could resource, that they could play with, almost as if it were some sort of plasticine. And he always had that extraordinary, playful, ingenious sort of energy with him. He was always extremely interested in probing the secrets of music, of literature. You know, he was in my house in Ireland on the 24th of July. He visited me with a group of people, his wife Helen, Sheila Denver, the singer, and Lillis O'Lair, the singer and scholar. We were rehearsing for something we did with the Symphony Orchestra with David Brophy a few weeks later. And even there, he was just profoundly engaged, joyful, detailed. You know, I certainly felt under the microscope, I had to know my stuff. He had very high standards, and I think everybody in RT who worked with him will acknowledge that whatever he did very well.
The castle called Sohram in Nuaginis Nadra Erluip Nakilis Glishil Uir of Yogrim Law Shin Ragur.
Éireann O'Linnard with Micheál O'Sullivan playing Casa an Tugan on the Today Show only 3 months ago. We'll go down to Léirc ar Lór, ach Marig a Chóil, go Joe. Micheál O'Sullivan, Suvna Shiri Dó. Children's rights campaigner Debbie Deegan, founder of the To Russia With Love charity, was in Moscow this week to receive the highest honour that can be bestowed on a Westerner. And at the glitzy dinner to mark the occasion, she was seated between the Russian Orthodox Patriarch, their equivalent of the Pope, and President Putin. Daunting, or what? She told Joe Duffy all about the moment when Vladimir met Debbie.
So he talked me through each of the acts and who they were and what they were and about all the different religions and cultures and everything coming together. And it was like a major river dance on the stage.
Okay, well, did he ask you anything about Ireland?
He asked me, had I ever met Colin McGregor? And so, I haven't.
Okay, hang on. The Russian president, you're sitting beside him. We've just had a new president elected in Ireland. We have a well-known government internationally because Leo Varadkar is in a lot of travelling with the whole Brexit scenario. And you're saying when the Russian president sat down and he discovered where he knew you from Ireland, he said to you, how's Conor McGregor?
Well, you see, don't forget, he's a judo expert and he's into that kind of stuff. I'm not. So my area is children and that's all I ever really bore.
So what did he ask you? What did he ask you about Conor, Debbie?
He just asked me, did I know him? And I don't, actually. And he asked me then just about Ireland. And so I said to him, we should consider coming to Ireland on a fishing trip. And I had just come out of Cleggan last Saturday night and I was thinking that Cleggan would be the perfect place to bring him.
When you're looking at him,
yeah,
and you're sitting beside him and he's talking about the culture of Russia and everything.
Yes.
You must be looking at him and saying, hang on a minute, Novichok, Salisbury, Crimea, Ukraine. Yeah. Didn't he say recently, I will poison my enemies?
To be perfectly honest, they're not on the Richter scale of what I would even think of when I'm sitting there looking at him. I had said to him on the stage that I hope I'm standing with him when he closes the last door of the last orphanage. And I'm there 20 years, Joe. And when I went in there 20 years ago, as you'll remember, there was 850,000 orphans in Russia. He has it down now to about 80,000. So when I'm sitting in front of him, the only thing I'm interested in talking about is childcare and child welfare and our orphan children. I'm not interested in anything else. And if I worked in any other country in the world, I'd be exactly the same. I have no interest in what the leaders of any country does. I'm interested in the children that don't have mummies and daddies and that have nobody to mind them. And I don't care what their leaders do.
Debbie Deegan heard on Liveline with Joe Duffy on Wednesday. Whatever about Russia, over in the United States, President Trump and CNN's Jim Acosta cut up rough during a news conference after the results of the midterm elections were announced.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN. All right. And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, are you worried?
That's enough.
Mr. President, Mr. President, I had one other question if I may ask on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have—
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead, Peter.
In Jim's defense, I've traveled with him and watched him. He's a diligent reporter who busts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of yours either, so
I understand.
To be honest.
So let me ask you a question if I can. You repeatedly
You are the best.
Mr. President, you repeatedly over the course
of— Okay, just sit down, please. Well, when you report fake news, no. When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
On The Gathering yesterday, Irish-American lawyer Larry Donnelly discussed the fallout with Sean O'Rourke.
The midterm elections in the US, good news for both parties, at least that's how it's been interpreted. Pollsters getting it right. But, you know, how do you see things unfolding? I mean, a pretty robust exchange between Donald Trump and the media. Maybe we journalists get obsessed by stuff like that. But he seems emboldened.
Well, at one level, you might say emboldened. At another level, you could say frightened, in a sense that his actions Wednesday, I think, lived up to what his worst critics would say about him. I mean, shouting somebody down, calling him a terrible person in front of everyone, it really was disgusting behavior and, I think, indefensible behavior. And I think quite surprising in light of what he said at first about the midterm results, in that it was a success. He's clearly worried about the Democrats having control of the House and what they might do and how they might make his life difficult for the next 2 years. That having been said, the big issue for the Democrats is how far do they push? How hard do they push? Because if they're seen to overreach, then there could be a backlash for them on that front. But Nancy Pelosi is going to have to contain a lot of new Democrats, this new wave of Democrats who were elected, a lot of whom will be stewing to start impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump. And I think that would be a very big mistake unless there's something potentially explosive from the Mueller investigation. We just haven't seen that yet.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. It was a tense week here on the political front, with the chances of a Brexit deal again dominating the headlines.
Taoiseach, what do you say to the suggestion that you've caved in on Brexiteer pressure to give concessions on a backstop?
No, what I said was the government would be open to exploring the possibility of maybe including a review mechanism.
Yeah.
That's what's called creative language.
Yeah.
It's a technique politicians use to say as little as possible with as many words as possible.
Taoiseach, do you have anything to say about Brian Hayes' decision to quit politics?
He's a role model for me, as he achieved so much salary while doing so little and still quit by the time he was 50. So Brian has now found his true calling as the CEO of the Payments and Banking Federation, standing up for the rights of bankers and the tax avoidance industry.
Taoiseach, what do you think of Tony O'Brien calling Simon Harris a frightened little boy?
Oh. Look, Simon may look like a frightened little boy. He may lack experience, charm, good looks and good luck. But what he clearly lacks in terms of experience or knowledge or capability, he more than makes up for in a bit of help here.
That ambition.
Yes.
I mean, not in relation to the health service, but, you know, political ambition.
Taoiseach, you said consultants and nurses should have to work right through Christmas. Don't you think that's a bit rich, given TDs get more holidays than Santa Claus?
Wrong. We get about half the holidays Santa gets.
Yeah.
And I was a doctor. I had to work in A&D on Christmas Day. Twice. And I still wake up screaming sometimes. So yeah, I'm in my rights to order tired and broken nurses to work through Crimbo, because I want to direct people's anger away from my party. All right. No more questions. Well, maybe one last one from her.ie.
Can we expect some hilarious Christmas socks this year, Tish?
Well, look, it's early days yet, but I have decided to form an exploratory committee on the possibility of some Rudolph-themed socks. Oh, I've said too much. Damn you, crack investigative reporters and your incessant digging.
All right, you guys, this press is over. Shame on all of you.
Shout out now.
Oliver Callan and his crew heard on Callan's Kicks last night. Another episode of the new RTE drama series Taken Down will air tomorrow night on RTE television, and already it's got people talking. The series focuses on asylum seekers and is set largely in a direct provision centre. It's co-written by best-selling crime writers Joe Spain and Stuart Carolan and directed by filmmaker David Caffrey, whose stellar credits include Love Hate, Peaky Blinders, Line of Duty and Prime Suspect. Joe Spain and David Caffrey joined Ryan Tuberty in studio on Monday.
I was struck last night in the programme about direct provision, and it drives me nuts about direct provision, because I feel that it is, there's something about direct provision that hasn't been discussed properly in this country, about the conditions, about who's in there, about their freedoms, and more importantly about their lack of freedoms. And for some reason I get the feeling that we're just not given the full picture. And I've wanted to go and visit one. I haven't had much joy getting into one, but what is the deal with direct provision in terms of accessibility, transparency? Joe?
I think it's, I mean, David will agree with me on this, it's fairly shocking. I do think that direct provision is something that in 10 years' time we're all going to look back on and say, how did that happen in our time, in the same way we do with mother and baby homes? I mean, it was set up in 1999. It was to be a short-term thing.
Yeah.
I think they were saying it would be 6 months and asylum would be processed. Now, 55% of them are in there over 5 years, and their children being born into direct provision, and they're institutionalised from birth. Hotel rooms, small units, parents aren't allowed to cook, curfews. They can be moved. I talked to a lot of parents who one day their kids are going to such and such a school, then they're being told they're being moved from Dublin to Kerry.
Randomly. Some can cook, some have facilities to cook in, some don't, isn't that it? Some have canteen-like facilities, and that's the difference.
Yeah, in the best, they have the cooking facilities in their rooms.
I mean, I don't think there's any magic bullet for it.
Yeah.
So the fact that we're talking about it now, I suppose with the show, we want to sort of highlight it so it becomes something that we talk about.
Yeah, tell us about your work in Line of Duty and Peaky Blinders. How have you enjoyed those experiences and learned from them?
They were terrific. I mean, again, where if you look at Peaky Blinders, Love Hate, Taken Down, they're all very, very strong, brilliant writers. So in terms of looking at those things, I've managed to start with amazing raw material. So in a way, marrying, I suppose I've just been very lucky. If you're trying to hire a director, you know, Napoleon was asked about which particular general, and there was one guy with great sort of accolades and statistics, and Napoleon said, yes, but is he lucky?
Yeah, and lucky generals are
you know, I'm certainly one of those.
Ever so humble, a bit of luck maybe, but shed loads of talent. David Caffrey and Joe Spain heard on The Tuberty Show. Another of Ryan's guests was Hazel Chu, who trained as a barrister at King's Inns. Hazel was born in Ireland to Chinese immigrants, and she's well aware of the sacrifices they made to fund her education. Her parents moved here from Hong Kong 40 years ago and ran a chip van when she was growing up. She described the racism they faced at the time.
I don't think people were quite used to the two of them. Unfortunately, there was some abuse. There was a lot of good sentiment. The neighbours were quite good, but there were one or two that I don't think really liked them having a business there.
And they made their unhappiness felt.
They did. It was the 80s. I think mum and dad were novelties, and so was I, because we looked different. So when people saw them in the chip van, like, most people were very kind, very supportive, but then you have one or two bad eggs, like with everything. But then that kind of started building, and one day, I remember this quite well, because it made them decide to buy a takeaway instead. Because,
to get out of the van,
because the van got vandalized, and the vandals were never caught, but it was very much alluded to them that they should get out of the country or get out of the area. So they bought a takeaway in Maynooth then, and then they built up and ran restaurants.
In the van, the casual comments that would have been made were, what sort of language are you talking about, and how offensive was it, or indeed how inoffensive was it?
The friendly ones range from my yellow friend to Chinky Dink to then the less pleasant ones were kind of, oh, you chink, kind of foreigner, or like foreigner was actually a nicer one, to be honest with you. So, but it got it. I think the later the night got, the later the evening got, the more offensive sometimes it got. With a few drinks.
Yeah.
And this happened with the takeaway as well. I remember once or twice when, if you refuse someone food, serving them because they were too drunk or too abusive, the initial reaction would be, well, feck off back to your own country. You're a guest here, feck off back to your own country. Yeah. And I think as a child, I didn't quite understand what that meant. But then as I grew up, it kind of became more and more obvious. When I was working in the takeaway, in my parents' takeaway, I encountered it once or twice. And it became very obvious to me that, yes, I think people do think I'm a guest in their country, but I was born and raised here. So, which is something that I kind of hit a lot more home in recent weeks. And especially since we have a daughter, I look at her these days and kind of go, well, you know, would the same thoughts be placed on her by people that she should go home?
From the Ryan Tuberty Show on Tuesday. The use of scramblers and quad bikes in public parks and playing fields has been a controversial topic for some time now, with Gardaí seemingly unable to stop the antisocial behaviour because of a grey area in the law. You may remember the terrifying case of a Lithuanian man who was left in a vegetative state after a scrambler crashed into him while he was sunbathing in Darndale Park in Dublin with his wife last June. Paddy O'Gorman met up with Angela Kotsinian. She described what happened to her husband, Ilabek Avetian.
When we went to Darndale Park, we were on the hill. The motorbicycle ran over his face, my husband, his face. Ilabek is turned on the left side and he couldn't move. He didn't say any voice and his face is all opened. I cried, what you done? I cried, you killed the man, what you done? He looked us and went. I had a meeting with doctors. The doctor said to me, if he leave, he will be in a vegetative situation.
You go to see him?
Every day I'm there. I'm living there.
Can he make a recovery or?
No.
Angela Kutsinian. Well, Paddy also visited Talca Valley Park in Finglas, where he met up with some local residents and some belligerent bikers.
Hello, man. Excuse me, man. Sorry. Would you mind if I spoke to you for a moment? Okay, would you speak to me just for a moment, Ivan? Would you mind?
Why?
This is a scrambler bike. What makes this a scrambler bike?
It's a good joke.
Yeah? It's a good joke. And does it go very fast?
Yeah. It goes fast enough, yeah, pal. Right. It goes fast enough.
No, some people are saying to me the two lads shouldn't be driving in the park here. What would you say to that?
F*** the whole lot. Remember me and they're all little rats.
They're all rats. Can you go anywhere else? Would you like to see tracks for scrambler bikes?
Yeah.
What would you like to see? Yeah?
Motocross tracks. It's a track.
For dirt bikes, go on.
Motocross tracks.
Is it a dangerous thing on a scrambler bike?
No. Not really. If you know how to drive them, then it's not dangerous at all.
You're not wearing helmets, either of you.
Yeah, that's because we're in a park. If we were out on the road, we would be wearing helmets.
No.
She's a flamer. she's a good one.
All right, but thank you.
Paddy O'Gorman reporting for the Today Show on Thursday. Tomorrow marks the centenary of the armistice, which saw the end of the First World War. 40 million soldiers and civilians died or were wounded in the conflict, and commemorative events will naturally focus on those involved in the fighting, including the many Irishmen, nationalists as well as unionists who fought in the British Army. In 1988, Morning Ireland series editor Shane McElhattan persuaded some of the surviving veterans to share their memories of that terrible war.
I didn't know what I had to go through. At 16 years of age, it's a crowd you gets together and you decide to do something, you'll do it.
And there was a terrific crowd of young fellas went into the army. It was the thing to do.
If there was another war and I was a young man, I'd go again.
And I well remember Kitchener's finger, your king and country need you. It's hard to believe those things, but we believed it as a young fellas because the nation volunteers, when we were told, the place to win the freedom of Ireland, the field of Flanders.
There were as many reasons for joining up as there were Irishmen who joined up to fight in the Great War. Idealism, nationalism, a family of children with no shoes, a young man's hunger for adventure. One thing they did share. Nothing they knew before remotely prepared them for what they endured. Where they endured, others died. And they spent the rest of their lives wondering why they survived, and so many others did not. Jack Campbell of the Black Watch Regiment began his war in September 1914, fighting sabre-wielding German cavalry in sun-dappled orchards and woods. He ended it 4 years later, choking on mustard gas in a poisoned, blasted wasteland. Along the way, he won the Victoria Cross for his attempt to save the life of Captain Fergus Bowes Lyon, the brother of the future Queen Mother, in 1915. He saw more than most. His testimony can stand for tens of thousands of Irishmen.
The conditions are the same on all fronts. You know, trenches, 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 that's all you know. Shelter, trenches, cold, wet. Once the trench warfare started, it became static.
With millions of men crammed into trenches and dugouts, the inevitable happened. A new enemy appeared. Vermin.
The bloody millions of fucking lice. Millions of lice. You were there and the rats were there. And if you had a bit of food that you were saving for an emergency, the only safe place was in your stomach. No matter where you hit it, the rats would get it. The lice was eating the flesh off the live ones, the live tummies, and the bloody rats was guarding themselves on the bodies of the dead ones. It wasn't living, really. The only way you could look at it, we were being punished. It was punishment. You were there, you were cold, you were wet. There was no way of getting warm. There was no way of drying your clothes. There was nothing you could do about it. You had to stay with it. You just couldn't say, I've had enough of this, I'm off.
Like most veterans of combat, Jack Campbell was reluctant to go into too much detail about the moment every Tommy dreaded, going over the top.
Well, you were in such a state mentally, you weren't thinking. You just had an objective, that's all, and you wanted to get there as quick as possible. You wanted to get into that trench as quick as possible to get shelter, safety.
And what did you do when you got it to the other side?
Well, you had to engage the enemy, you had to drive the enemy back if it was possible. If it wasn't possible and he was able to drive you back, he drove you back.
What was that like? What was trench warfare?
Sure,
like
bloody it? Hell. That's the only thing you could call it. Yeah, you just threw anywhere you seen anything moving. If you thought there was anybody down the dugout, just pull the pin out and down the dugout with one. It was just kill, that's all. Kill or be killed.
For some, it was all too much.
Did you see anybody deserting?
Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. You see, there was such a thing then as shell shock. Fellas had run this way and run that way, and the lads were suffering from shell shock. Like a madman running around. It was only natural, the brain gave way.
A short extract there from Shane McElhattan's powerful report heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Over on Liveline, the annual debate about the wearing and the symbolism of the poppy raged all week. On Tuesday, we heard from Alan Barry in the UK. He's Irish by birth and lived in this country for much of his life. He's also a former British soldier who served in Northern Ireland. Also on the line was Oliver, a self-described Irish Republican.
Look, nobody can go on television in England during the month of November, Joe, unless they wear the poppy. It's been forced on people. James McLean has been absolutely destroyed over there in England. And not a word from the FA in England. Not as much as a word about it.
Well, that's fair, isn't it, Alan?
I suppose to a certain extent. James McLean gave a statement about why he doesn't wear a poppy. And my only issue with that is, if you're in a country, and he's lived here for many years, and he's earned his living here, and he's happy to live here.
Yeah, but
you know, there's an old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans.
Yeah, but I also, where was I reading this morning, that if you go around London, you don't see countless thousands wearing the poppy.
No, I agree, yeah. But James McLean is a public figure. And, you know, on that particular, is it really such a big deal to have that on his shirt?
And it's a symbol, isn't it? Symbol, isn't it?
Joel, it is a big deal.
But this is the whole point. It's not a symbol. This is the whole point. It's not a symbol of British imperialism.
But that's what it is. That's what it is,
no,
Alan.
No, but Oliver, it isn't. Think about it.
It is, Alan. I'm sorry, I disagree with you.
Well, Adam, what are you saying? It's a remembrance of the poppies in the green fields of France.
No, Oliver, it isn't. And let me explain why.
Alan, it is a symbol of British imperialism, no matter what you say, it is.
Okay, so what about the 36,500 Irishmen? Irishmen, not British, Irishmen, from Dublin and many other counties across Ireland, who joined the British Army to fight German imperialism in the First World War, because it was Germany that invaded.
They should have stayed at home in their own country fighting for Ireland in 1916. That's what they should have done.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Tuesday. RTE's David McCullough is well known as a broadcaster, but he's also a distinguished historian. And on This Week last Sunday, he reported on a newly discovered letter by Eamon de Valera to his wife Sinead, written from his prison cell in Lincoln Jail, which reveals his feelings as he heard about the armistice.
I have just heard the sirens and bells which announce that the armistice with Germany has been signed. It will bring relief to many an anxious heart. It will bring joy to many, but how many homes, when the joy bells cease ringing, will be plunged into grief. For the sake of the women of the world, at any rate, I am glad it is over. They it is who have suffered most. Their imaginings have been far worse than the worst horrors the men have had to endure.
The letter forms part of an online exhibition by UCD Archives marking the centenary of the armistice. It's part of a much larger cache of previously unseen letters, mainly from De Valera to his wife Sinead, recently donated to UCD Archives by the De Valera family.
At the end of 1918, you had the end of the armistice, the end of the war. I was in Lincoln at the time.
Kate Manning, senior archivist here in the archives. I mean, I suppose if you're an archivist and you suddenly come across a bunch of previously unseen papers, it must be a very exciting moment.
It certainly is. I suppose for these particular letters, because they're personal letters, and that's why it distinguishes them. And that, for a man who had such a long public career, to have kind of insight into his private life and private thoughts, that makes them even more interesting.
That insight into the private De Valera is particularly valuable given his rather austere public image.
The ideal Ireland that we would have, the Ireland that we dreamed of, would be the home of a people who valued material wealth only as a basis for right living.
So what insights do the new letters supply? Grandson Dr. Eamon De Valera explains.
A mixture of his philosophy with the mundane and, of course, concern for family. They illustrate how close he was to my grandmother.
He weaves in and out of Irish and English. Sentiments expressed are very tender, and he's very honest about his feelings. But he's also very particular about, you know, what he wants when he's in prison. He likes his books. He queries why he hasn't received them yet, those kinds of things. So they're very interesting.
The letter to be published in the online exhibition shows that on November 11th, 1918, Eamon de Valera was not convinced that this was the war to end all wars.
The thoughts that occur to me here today would fill volumes. Thoughts on the vanities of men and of empires. Vanities which the lessons of this war will not dispel. 100 years ago, 'twas Napoleon. This time 'twas Germany. Whose turn will it be next?
The voice of Paddy Keogh as Eamon de Valera, ending David McCullough's report on This Week, a programme which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Yesterday, Ray D'Arcy was joined by country music star Nathan Carter. He's only 28, but he's already released his autobiography called Born for the Road. It's all about his childhood, life on the tour bus, and the story behind Wagon Wheel, the hit that made him a household name. During the interview, Ray noticed something in a lot of the pictures of Nathan as a child.
Daniel, do you know what I noticed about the pictures in the books? Like, was there just microphones in the house all the time? there seems to be a microphone in every photo.
Yeah, I think most kids get taken to a toy shop for presents. I got taken to the music shop.
Did you?
To see Ronnie, and I would buy a mic, or I would buy a tambourine, or any musical instrument I could find.
And what were they? Did you have a little PA in the house, or what were they playing?
We had a karaoke machine,
right?
With little tape decks in them. I remember it vividly, actually. Two tape decks and a big speaker underneath. So I guess that started from a young age, trying to figure out how I could plug mics into stuff and get it going. So, yeah, I've always been a bit of a geek, I guess.
And why Wagon Wheel? Where did you find that song?
A friend of mine, she was playing, had it as her ringtone one day, and I was in Fermanagh, and she was her phone rang, and I said, what's that song? And she said, this is a band called the Old Crow Medicine Show. They're a bluegrass band, and this is one of their big songs. And I said, oh, geez, play it again, will you? She said, well, ring me. Play it again. Yeah. So I rang her again, and it's kind of annoyingly catchy, that song. So I took it in the studio and did my own arrangements of it. We stuck drums, obviously, and bass on it, and accordion and stuff, and did a good bit different now to the Old Crow Medicine Show version. But it did well at the start, and then it didn't get played for a while, and then it just got, it was one of them songs that just seemed to having, it had a life of its own. It died for a bit and then it got played again, and then I might have sang it on the Late Late or something, and then it got even more. So yeah, it was just a really good song. So rock me mama like a wagon wheel, rock me mama any way you feel, hey, hey, yeah, mama rock me, yeah, rock me mama like the wind and the rain, rock me mama like a southbound train, hey, hey, yeah, mama rock me.
Nathan Carter heard on the Ray Darcy Show yesterday. Open a newspaper these days or turn on the radio and chances are you'll find a debate on the topic of veganism. So why do vegans attract so much controversy? Today reporter Evelyn O'Rourke went out onto the streets of Dublin to meet vegans and carnivores alike to put bones on the story.
Veganism to me is more than a diet, it's really a lifestyle. It's basic morals, because we believe that no one should be oppressed, and we see animals not as something that is a commodity but as something that lives and breathes and is sentient like us, so you should not oppress it or use it in any way.
How long have you been a vegan for, and was it difficult?
I've been vegan for 1.5 years now, and we went cold turkey, so yeah, my fiance and me.
You both went vegan at the same time?
Yes.
Well, she was vegetarian for 7 years before, and it made me curious about it, and I watched some documentaries and I realised it's the way to go, like, morally, health-wise as well. But now, my mother's become vegan since I went vegan, my sister's become vegan, a lot of our best friends have gone vegan as well.
All from your influence?
Yeah.
How you doing? I'm Donald Cahill, the owner of My Meat Wagon in Spitfield.
Many vegetarian options?
No, none.
Any vegan options?
Zero.
What do you have on your menu?
Cow, pig or bird, that's it. Nothing else in the menu. I only live up the road and it's like a vegan restaurant at every corner now at the moment. And we're like the devil down here. Vegan lifestyle. Look, if they want to live in a cult, that's fine with me.
Can I ask you, what have you ordered for dinner this evening?
A cow on a board, I think it's called. So I think it's just a selection of beef products on a board.
Do you love your meat?
I do, I'm a butcher.
What do you make of vegans?
I don't know, they're very in your face and they want you to know that they are vegans. Like, I wouldn't walk around saying, oh, I eat meat every day.
In some aspects, it can be some craziness to it, but I think people do it for health reasons. I think people do it for religious reasons, but other than that, it's up to them.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for Monday's Today Show. Lisa Brennan-Jobs is the daughter of artist Chris Ann Brennan and Apple founder Steve Jobs. Her new memoir, Small Fry, is about her turbulent life and relationship with one of the world's most powerful men. Steve Jobs initially denied paternity, even after a court-ordered DNA tests, but they eventually reconciled, and he accepted he was Lisa's father when she was 8 years old.
When he was dying, I think it might have been one of the last times you spoke to him, he reminded you that when you lost your virginity, he was the first person you spoke to about it, and he was quite proud of that.
So embarrassing, you know, you write a memoir and then you're talking about your virginity on the radio
yes.
In Ireland. but he was the first person I went to and I had forgotten. And it might have been in part because we hadn't grown up together. You know, I didn't really start to get to know him till I was 8. And so the sort of cringe factor that people often have with their parents and telling their parents such secrets, I didn't really have, because he felt like, in that regard, more of a friend, I think.
But he had
been a good friend in that way.
Why do you think it was so important to him?
And it was nice when he was dying. Why was it so important to him to remind me that I had come to him with such important information?
Yes.
I think because it had made him feel in that moment like he was a good father. And I think in some real ways, he was a good father. Hmm. I think he did really love me. And I think he wanted to remind me that moment had been very special to him. And I also thanked him for being so open about that. And he was very sick at the time, and we were in the car, he started jumping up and down kind of in the car seat. He was in the passenger seat. He said, I was trying to be positive. I was trying to be helpful. And I thought, oh, I guess you really, you know, it's really important to thank people when they're dying for what they did well. I hadn't realized how much he might have been being hard on himself. And he needed to understand that it was a balance of parts where there were failures and parts where there were real successes.
Lisa Brennan-Jobs with Ray Darcy. It's no secret that Anthony Horowitz is one of Ryan Tuberty's favourite writers. His latest book is called The Sentence is Death. So they talked plots and twists and, of course, bookshelves, as you do.
Do you keep your books? Do you have, like, multiple shelves, or are you kind of clean lines?
I have about 2,500 books in my house, or maybe maybe more, 3,000 books. And I tend not to put them in. I mean, they're not in alphabetical order. I always mistrust anybody who puts their books or their DVDs in alphabetical order. Get a life. That sort of thing. And I'm not, they're not in any, you know, all my Dickens is together and my Trollope's are together and my Thackeray's are together. So by author, they're all sort of arranged. My paperbacks are everywhere, including the one you very kindly gave me when we last met. But the funny thing is that although there are so many books in the house, if you asked me to go and reach for a book, I could tell you exactly where it was. I could find it instantly. It's a strange thing. So it's disorganised, but I know where everything is.
Well, like my shelves would be, I've got a very small, inconsequential television dumped in the corner, so I'm not, but the shelves are to the left. So I find myself, when the TV's boring me, drifting to the spines of the books. And so maybe it's by osmosis. I could tell you where a book might be, even though there's no order to it.
Well, you know, houses need books. I mean, this is something I've been talking about all my life, that children who grow up surrounded by books are more likely to read. Yeah. And you know from our past conversations how important I think literacy is in this world. Mm-hmm. You were talking earlier about civil discourse, and where do you learn civility? Where do you learn empathy for other people? Where do you learn politeness and manners and goodness and all those things you were talking about only a few minutes ago? They begin in books, in fiction in particular. Where did we come from? Where are we going? How do we all get into this planet together? Fiction has the answer. Mm-hmm. And for me, books, and this is different from e-books or any other sort of thing, just actually the physicality of having books around you. As I said, a bookshop in a high street gives that high street soul, and books in a house give it the same thing, that sense of friendship and warmth. And so my books are terribly important to me. I mean, some of them were left to me by my father, so they're memories of him. Some of them were given to me by friends, and I remember them every time I go back to them. Some of them, of course, are just great stories that I revisit, particularly 19th century literature, which is my own favourite area. But every single book that I have, even the ones which I haven't quite finished, mean something to me, and I can't imagine my life without them.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show on Wednesday. But for the weekend that's in it, I leave you with voices from Liveline and a song from June Tabor called No Man's Land, which Joe Duffy played yesterday. Gurmag of Asrogoluther, Tasilam Gurwanshiv Saltasaglor, Agiskmeshiv Lumtaka and Amakena, and Sachtin Chahugin, Gijishin, Gijeshib Slan.
Well, how do you do, Private William McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside?
It was my grandfather. I have a photograph of me sitting on his lap when I was about 3 or 4. And the thought struck me that, you know, I could talk to him, I could see him, but he couldn't see me. There was a major mustard gas attack. My grandfather lost his sight due to that mustard gas attack. So obviously he was blind for life. It might seem unfortunate, but he was actually one of the lucky ones, because obviously he was actually brought home.
Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the pipe lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as the Lord ye down? Did the bugles sing the last boast in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
He wound up in Mons, and he was wounded and taken prisoner in his hospital bed. He was very badly treated by the Germans, really badly beaten up, threatened to be shot several occasions, sent on the train then into Germany, where they opened at different stops. They invited people to hurl abuse at him and throw stuff at him and his compatriots. They burst his eardrum. He spent 3 years in a prisoner of war camp.
Just a stranger without even a name, forever enclosed behind some glass pane, in an old photograph torn and tattered and stained, and fading to yellow in a brown leather frame.
He had post-traumatic syndrome, and he was in a very bad way. By the early 1930s, he was on the edge. He wasn't doing well. And he ended up then going in and out of Grange Gorman. You know, he eventually ended the whole thing in a river near another mental institution, in 1937 when he was 39, he drowned himself.
Oh,
so on top of that, then his family had £1 a week to live on from the army pension, the British army pension, and they had nothing. They were very, very poor. What was ironic was to the mental institution was trying to get some money, get his wife some of the money taken away from her so that they could get some support for him while he was in for treatment. But of course, she had six young children between 1 and 12, so she couldn't do that.
Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers tall?